Hi, this is Jay Nemro. You're listening to The Life Autistic. This is episode number 660. Oh my gosh, I lost it again. Oh! Faith and anxiety. If you don't know before, I retain one organizational affiliation. I only have one. I find that when I get involved with an organization, it's always somewhat disappointing to me. I am an idealist, somewhat of a purist. And therefore, there's only a couple of things I can feel like I really want to be associated with. And the one organizational affiliation that I have, that I intend to stick with for the rest of eternity, is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I am a Mormon. And of course, one of the discriminating parts of being a Mormon, separates you from other Christians. Of course, most Christians don't consider Mormons Christians, whatever. You know, you guys can say whatever you want to say, who cares? You guys have about that much influence in the world anymore, so, you know, if Christians speak poorly of you, you can shrug a lot because, you know, most of them are, you know, I don't want to say that. A lot of the things that they say don't make them sound like they have great creeds in the first place. So I tend to kind of say, well, that's just nice. Mormons strive to be followers of Jesus Christ. I'm not going to say they're Christians because that just offends Christians. I will say that they try to be followers of Jesus Christ in their own way. Okay? One of the big discriminating factors of being a Mormon is that we have more scripture. We believe, I've come to know, God let me know that this is true, that there is, you know, there is additional scripture besides just the Bible that we have now. And it's called, and one of those is called the Book of Mormon. It was written by people who lived here on the American continent in Mesoamerica. They were called Nephites and Lamanites, and they had wars, and God showed himself to some of them. They had prophets, things like that. Very, very much an offshoot of the Jews, of the children of Israel. Anyway, so in that book, there toward the very end of a book called First Nephi, or Second Nephi, Second Nephi. The main author of it, whose name is Nephi, talks about, he's kind of preparing to give his farewell, and I think he's trying to sum up a little bit of what he wishes people would know and understand. And one of his statements, and I apologize for paraphrasing, I don't really have a Book of Mormon in here in the car with me, which is sad. I should have it here, because I make reference to it often enough, and I should be reading it, and I didn't do it again. God. I'm always forgetting something that's somewhat vital. Anyway, in this thing, it talks about what's important, or about what helps Nephi. And I boiled it down to a formula. You know, I can't say I'm terribly scientific, but I tend to have a mind that likes things that are kind of on the simple side. I think a lot of truth comes from simplicity. You know, is that in Occam's, are they called Occam or Occam, whatever, Occam's razor kind of way of looking at things, which is to say, chances are the simplest explanation for something is probably the right one, as opposed to something that's really complicated that you've, you know, worked out. It's got this complicated formula to it. Einstein, when he explained his theory of how energy relates to mass, you know, E equals mc squared. That's simple. Anybody can take a look at that and go, oh, I understand the formula now. Now you may not understand the concepts of energy from mass has a relationship to the speed of light. You know, that might go past something. But everybody knows E equals MC squared. You know, it's a simple thing that people have struggled over just to how all that stuff works, and he just came up with something that I guess the math actually works. Or at least he's speculating it will. I don't have any clue otherwise. You know, I haven't researched and I haven't read up on it to see what kind of proofs there are that Einstein was right in that particular formula. So here's the simple formula that I have developed from this little bit at the very end of 2 Nephi. I forget which chapter and which verse, but it was talked about a little bit. And it is this: faith plus anxiety, anxiousness, equals revelation. Now there's more to it than that. You know, it goes on. Revelation leads to other things, but I found it very exciting. That an exciting insight that I had never really read before, that faith and anxiety, and he talks about it that way. He says this is how one gets, how he got revelation. He was speaking of we. I don't know who the we really was. It might have been he and his younger brothers, which were Joseph and Jacob. Jacob being the one that we know the most about because he took up the record after Nephi. The book of 2 Nephi is followed by the book of Jacob, which was predominantly written by Jacob, his brother. Younger brother, significantly younger. Anyway, that might have been the we he was talking about. Or maybe he was just talking in general about people who were getting inspiration, getting revelation. You have to be anxious about something. He spoke of being anxious about the welfare of his people, and that coupled with faith made it so they had revelation. And that revelation was about Christ and about what would come and the fact that that gave all of them hope in the future. Because they lived in a tough time. The Lamanites, who were actually the nation that was built by the older brothers of Nephi, who hated Nephi and hated his children, hated everybody about Nephi, everybody who was near Nephi, they were called the Nephites. They hated. So there were constantly wars going on between them, and the decadence and the horrors of the Lamanites were just legendary. And of course, it's somewhat depressing to see that happen, to constantly be fighting, trying to stay alive. The Nephite people dwindled then. Eventually they would dwindle completely and just be wiped out completely. Not in Nephi's time, surely. Many generations later that would ultimately happen. But they were already seeing that the whole outlook of the Lamanites was starting to get very attractive to others. They were getting killed by the Lamanites, but they were also losing people to evil. And that this idea gave them hope. If you're anxious about something, you will have revelation for how to take care of it. Let me tell you some of the things that I get anxious about and what I felt like I have gotten some revelation on. Now, first of all, you have to understand that I think you've already noticed it. I am a person of very narrow interest. I read encyclopedias. I study in encyclopedias. I like feeding my mind. But when it gets down to it, I have very limited interests. I have tried here to try to get an interest in amateur radio. But honestly, I'm finding it not purposeful enough to be interesting enough to go out and get. I may very well go out and get my license. I'm going to go for my, what's it called, extra? Yeah. Or the advanced. I forget. They've changed the terminology over the last 10 years, and I get confused at that level. I'm going to try for the highest license you can have, which is based a lot on theory and stuff like that, and on operating practice, things like that, about electronics and electricity and, radiator theory, I guess that's what a transmitter is. It's an intentional radiator. But, you know, I was thinking about just going and doing that. You know, it only costs, what, $20? I don't even think it costs that. To go out and try to get this thing, go ahead and take all the tests. If I fail that one, I'll most likely have my general. Boy, if I do really poorly, I'll just get my technician license. And I was thinking about just getting that without ever really having the intention of actually getting it on the air. Because, I don't know, I would look at it more as just a credential of saying, you know, this guy knows theory. He knows some stuff. That was where a lot of my certifications come from. I didn't really cram for them. You know, I didn't take that normal route. I had the information in my head. This is my A-plus and my Network Plus certifications, the ones that I have. It was just a confirmation that I knew what I was talking about. I knew what I was doing. That's probably why I'm not too hip to go out and get, like, my Microsoft certified engineer, you know, Microsoft certified computer engineer, my MCSE, for instance, which used to be one of the big ones. Everybody had to have that if they were going to get considered anything at all, you know. I don't look at that the same way as I do my others. I am simply looking for some verification of the knowledge that I have. I might someday go out and get my Linux Plus if it doesn't cost too much and if I've got the spare money. If I think that's going to help me over time to say, okay, Jay's got this certification, that's cool. But it wasn't because I crammed my head full of facts and figures so that I could regurgitate them at test time. I'm not interested in that. I really want to be great in depth on that stuff. So, like I said, I've got very narrow interests, and those interests have to be really purposeful for me. Amateur radio, I would only get an amateur radio license to say that I had that I have mastered this body of knowledge. Not so that I could yak at people on the radio. I'm not social. I don't like chit-chat particularly, which is what amateur radio tends to be. It's just a bunch of chit-chat. I find that even on the things that I have accessible to me, like IRC, you know, the Internet Relay Chat stuff, I find that either I offend people horribly on that, or it doesn't really interest me. It's mostly people yakking about nothing, about fluff. And that really doesn't interest me. Although I've found other IRC rooms, channels, whatever they get called sometimes, to be really good that way. Kind of ones where an expert on a certain piece of software or something like that comes in and chats with people. You know, there's a Linux one. Almost every piece of software has a chat room where people are kind of logged in and it's their kind of thing. Especially if they become an expert on it, you know. If some company pays that person to provide technical support, that's a cheap way to provide technical support for something, especially when there's only one or two people that are really technically experts on it. Mostly the people who wrote the thing in the first place. Anyway, I think I could be one of those kinds of people. Otherwise, I'm not. Anyway. I'm not really interested in getting into a piece of software particularly because, you know, for being somebody who's a computer technician who does that for money, I don't see that as my great skill. My great purpose in life isn't to be a computer tech. I have other interests that are more interesting to me and that I do. Most of them involve with the LDS Church. That becomes my major obsession. And so, like Nephi, I've gotten anxiety. I'm anxious about it. My mind is often turned almost solely to that. And so let me go ahead and talk about some of the insights that I've gotten. If it's, you know, sometimes that's tricky and I don't want to get into it too deeply. Just because they're of a sacred nature and because they're somewhat private and because there's stuff that really, really doesn't want to be, you know, that you don't really want to talk about very much. So I've got to be really careful here. So I hope you don't mind that in this whole huge setup that I got to get here, now I might be kind of disappointing in the fact that I'm not going to reveal a ton, although I don't mind revealing little bits and pieces. I have been studying very much the Church Handbook of Instructions, what parts of it I have access to, mostly to the ones it's about how to run auxiliaries and things like that. It's very sad to see, and it's very depressing, and I guess that's part of my anxiety, is how few people actually do what the handbook says. And the handbook is usually very open. You know, it's usually very much a thing that says, you know, these are the things that we suggest. These are the things that you should do. Sometimes it says you need to do it this way. And when you read them, you start to get a sense. And I'll talk about the brethren. Those are the leaders of the church, the guys who actually wrote these manuals. You know, they do it under inspiration. You know, they're trying to lead the church, trying to administer the church in the way that the Lord, Jesus Christ, wants it done. And it's been very interesting to see how the trends go. Basically, they're very long trends, because they don't act very fast. They try to be very careful. Although every now and then you have to take some time to just say, okay, this is how we're going to do it for now until we get some more information. Just lately, the church prophet announced the fact that they had gone through one of these big surveys and had decided not to change anything yet. Not to say that nothing was going to change in the future, but that they didn't feel compelled to make any changes. Although in their hearts they wanted to try. They wanted to try to make the bishop's job, which is your local leader of the church. You know, your local congregation has a bishop over it, who's a volunteer. No, he's not a volunteer. He is assigned, you know. There's nobody gets paid for this, at least on this level. And you know, they were trying to lighten that man's load, because often his load gets pretty heavy. Some of it's done by revelation. The Doctrine and Covenants receives much of the revelation that was given to Joseph Smith. Many of those revelations are administrative in nature. This is how you run the church. This is how I want it done. And so a lot of what bishops are asked to do are wrapped up in those revelations. And I've been having some insights lately as to how to do this. Now, I am in no position to actually do this at my present, so I don't know if it's a prelude to getting into a position where these things get discussed and where you have, you know, where you have their ear. I'm not saying I'm going to become one of the brethren. I don't know that. But, you know, there are other things, not to write new policy, but to take a fresh look, which is what Zenith/autistic/Asperger's obsessive people can offer. Because it's certainly what I'm accused of is, boy, that's a whole different take on this stuff that normal people really don't tend to see. So then that may be something upon which I am really, you know, a service I can really offer to the church is my anxiousness, my anxiety over it. And I do. I get really up in arms about saying, rah, 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 I wish they'd do it. I wish they'd follow the book better. I said, because I think doing it this way would be better. Traditionally in the Mormon church, there are basically two men that have keys in your local congregation. Keys are the actual authority to preside and to oversee what happens in the church in relation to ordinances, in relation to making sure that things are done correctly, just basically making sure the church is doing what it's supposed to be doing. And those two people are the bishop, and the other one is the elders quorum president. The elders quorum consists of, for the most part, all of the adult men who have the priesthood are part of the elders quorum. There's also a high priest group too, but I kind of, you know, the high priest group is kind of, I don't want to call it an elite core, kind of the leadership core of a larger region called a stake, a larger administrative unit, for lack of a better term for it. It's called a stake. Like, I have a stake. It's based in Amarillo, Texas. My local unit is based in Tucumcari, New Mexico. It's called a branch because it's so small. We have something analogous to a bishop. It's called a branch president. Because of our size, we don't justify having a bishop. So we have a branch president who mostly fills the same role as a bishop does, but, you know, doesn't have some of those attributes, does have some of them, you know. Just, and it's mostly because in a smaller thing, you're not going to have as experienced people. So you don't give the advanced responsibilities to a person in those circumstances. Even though you might have a person that has experience and has even been a bishop. You know, a branch president often gets lumped in with the bishops. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Anyway, there are those two people who have that, who have those keys. Traditionally, and sadly, sad to say, a bishop tends to be probably takes his responsibility, because he actually has kind of a three-pronged role. Number one, he is the president of the Aaronic priesthood, which is the young men and those adults who have not chosen to step up to the plate of having the Melchizedek priesthood, which is the higher priesthood. You know, he presides over that. He is also called the common judge in Israel, which is that if somebody sins significantly, does something, especially something that would bring, that would tarnish the reputation of the church by this person having done this thing, you know, adultery, fornication, embezzlement, anything that's illegal, but also more serious sins in the sight of God, you know, those get taken to the bishop, and he judges what kind of discipline that you need to help get you back right with, number one, the Lord, number two, with the church. If it's a really tight, small, if it's a smaller thing, sometimes you can take care of the repentance yourself, and it doesn't really require a bishop being involved. But by and large, it's a good idea to at least let the bishop know what's going on, and he can determine how big it is, you know, and how much it affects your standing with the church. And then the third one is that he is the presiding high priest. That is, you know, he kind of coordinates everything else. Everything in the branch or in the ward kind of goes through him. You know, not that he does the work, but he is kind of your, to put it into computer terms, he's your checksum to make sure things are going okay. Of course, bishops are imperfect, honestly. Far from perfect. And to a certain degree, they don't do a terribly good job on any of the three. A lot of bishops get caught up, and it's somewhat of a traditional thing. I don't think it's doctrinal at all, but they get really caught up, and because it's a very heady thing in the presiding high priest role. They like that role. And a lot of bishops and branch presidents, you know, get very, kind of think of that as their major role. Of those three roles that they have, they think that they tend to start leaning toward the presiding high priest as being their biggest one. Usually to the detriment of the elders, quorum, president, also to the high priest group leader. I'll refer most to the elders, quorum, president for the very reason that that is the guy that has keys. Those are a person that's given keys. The high priest group leader doesn't have any keys. Although his status, you know, the same basic structure that is in the elders' quorum is also in your local high priest group. There's actually a high priest quorum that composes all the high priests in the state. Anyway, so, you know, we have all these things. What ends up happening, and I was just thinking about this last night, was that the bishop actually ends up kind of setting himself up as the senior elders' quorum president. The actual elders' quorum president himself ends up being some kind of a subordinate, which isn't really right. That isn't correct. They aren't precisely lateral to each other. It isn't like they wield the same power. They don't really wield much power at all. It's because I think the keys given to a bishop aren't the keys of being the presiding high priest. Those aren't the keys. The keys are being the president of the Aaronic priesthood and being the common judge. Those are the two larger responsibilities. Now, being the common judge hopefully doesn't have to happen very often. It should be something that is an occasional role that he must play. By and large, in other things, he doesn't play that role very often. The biggest role he needs to play, and the one for which he very definitely has keys for, is to be come on, Jake. Oi. To be the president of the Aaronic priesthood. And it's so needed. Like I said, in most wards, there are two men that are supposed to oversee the families of the ward. The high priest group leader and the elders' quorum president. The elders' quorum president being probably the predominant one. Now, I know that'll make high priest group leaders very angry because they feel like they have a higher status. And you go, no, just because you are the local leader of the leadership corps doesn't mean you're more important than the guy who is just basically over the general Melchizedek priesthood, which is the elders' quorum president, the man who actually has keys given to him, authority of presidency. That's why you don't call the high priest group leader. He's not called the president. No keys. It's very simple. Anyway, you know, you don't need yet another man being shoved into this and start kind of being, well, I'm the senior sawbones around here. You know, you go, no. You go, you need to stay out of that. You have other fish to fry that are much more important. The youth. The youth, the youth, the youth, the youth, the youth. How important is that? How many youth do we lose? And you know what? It becomes contingent on that bishop. That's his major role, I think. Now, there might be somebody come back to me, somebody from the brother or somebody like that, that says, no, Jay, you're wrong. You're wrong. They're all equal. And you go, well, I don't think they should be. Because then who is really watching over the Aaronic priesthood? Who's presiding over them? Nobody is. If you're president of the priest quorum, which is actually what the bishop's basic title is, the president of the priest quorum, if he's off being more concerned about other needs, then I'm sorry, he's shortchanging the youth. You should have a perfectly good elders quorum present, sadly enough, in the church. Often, your most confident man is not the elders quorum president. He is made a counselor to a branch president, which means he's something of an assistant to him. And you go, what a horrible waste of material. You know? That guy should be your elders quorum president. Shouldn't be anybody else. Well, I'm sorry. Now that's what logic says. One has to consult with the Lord, but one should study this out first. One should be anxious about this, exercise faith, like I was saying before, and then you get revelation. Who's the right person? Who's the right person? And so that's one of the things that came to me. Bishops should leave the adults in the capable hands, and one should be careful that those people are capable. Being the elders quorum president shouldn't be a job that you give to somebody who's just kind of a, yeah, we're just going to fill this job. It should be your number two person. It should be your most capable elder. The high priest group, you should be able to leave them to their own devices, throw the worst problems with them, because that's the core of leaders. These are mostly former bishops and former stake leaders. You know, these are your proven, tried, fantastic guys. You should be able to leave them to their own devices to go off and handle the really big, sticky problems of families, of adults, in the church. The bishop shouldn't have to really sweat that particularly, except to get reports back and to make sure these things are coordinated so they're not, you know, doing more work than they need to, stepping on toes to make sure nobody's being forgotten. That's the most important thing a bishop should be about when it comes to adults, is just to make sure things are happening okay. And if there's special things that only he knows, relationships between certain people that would make for bad shepherding, that's kind of a Christian term for what we call home teaching, makes for bad home teaching, which is the basic function of the Melchizedek priesthood, taking care of families. This is the established way it's done through home teaching. I find, you know, anyway, so that was one of the big revelations I've gotten, because I'm anxious about this. I've been an elders quorum president. I've been an elders quorum president, and often I was slapped down by bishops who were trying to kind of lord over me, bishops and branch presidents, you know, who were saying, this is the way I want it done. And it's like, excuse me, hello, do I have keys, or are these just little plastic kitty keys that don't open anything? You know, do I have keys or do I not? And the bishop does not give the keys to the elders quorum president. This is not the fact that your elders quorum president, you report to the bishop, and that's the way it is. That person is actually called, set apart, and is responsible to the stake president, which is the next level up. So, to be honest, a bishop and an elders quorum president are more lateral to each other than, you know, up and down. And that's something that's been lost in a lot of wards and a lot of branches. This is your co-worker. This is not your subordinate. And that gets kind of mucked up. I tend to take a very militaristic view of the priesthood, you know. When I talk about line leaders and stuff like that, it gets a military bent for me because I see that as very orderly. And the priesthood is very orderly, or is supposed to be very orderly. And when it's not, it really makes me crazy, makes me anxious. So that when I apply my faith to that anxiety, I get revelation. And other people need to do that too. Interesting insights. And I've gotten a lot more that I'm not going to talk about on podcasts because they're not really appropriate for this kind of venue. And this is something that is that an autistic person, Asperger's, Zenith, whatever, obsessed person, has a very special ability to do. One who focuses their narrow interests, and that's one of the hallmarks now, isn't it? Those of you who are Asperger's or autistic or have been diagnosed, that's one of the things on it. Very narrow interests. And my very narrow interest has gotten shoved toward the church. That's what I like. My soul affiliation is with this. In simpler talk, you can call me a church man, because I am. It's what I do. It's what I spend my nights dreaming about and pondering and saying, I wonder what would be the best thing to do there. Anyway, there's that insight. That insight it was brought up beautifully by that few verses in 2 Nephi. If anybody ever says, "Oh, I don't believe the Book of Mormon because it can't possibly be the Word of God," I can testify that's true because of the wonderful insights I've gotten from it and just in 100 things, not just this. This is just one simple example that just kind of popped out at me from a scripture that I probably would have just glanced over and said, yeah, whatever, in the past. Since I'm going now reading the Book of Mormon very slowly now, usually only a verse or two, and then thinking about the insights that's giving me, there it is. Faith plus anxiety equals revelation. This is Jane Emerald. I know it's kind of interesting if you're not a Mormon. You're kind of going, "Well, it's kind of boring and stupid. I don't like it." And you go, "Well, understand, okay. Are you getting insights from the Bible? Do you get insights like this from the Bible?" And I'm not trying to compare the Book of Mormon with the Bible. To me, they are equivalent. If you are a quote-unquote Christian, and you don't get these kinds of insights from the Bible, I would have to say you should. You should. Don't spend your time relying upon getting this information from some pastor or from some priest. You know, the joy of the Reformation was that the Bible was put into the hands of a common man so that he could make his own, he could get his own insights. I don't want to talk about different interpretations. But honestly, having that stuff in your hands as a regular person is very powerful. That was one of the huge things that, number one, the old Catholic Church, the old very controlling Catholic Church, fought tooth and nail against, was letting people have the Bible. This was something that the normal person should not have in their hands. They can't understand that. It needs to be interpreted by priests and bishops and people like that so that they might have it correct, you know. That's how the whole term of orthodoxy got started, was that you couldn't give the base information to regular people. They might decide that they didn't need their priest anymore. They might come to that juncture in their personal walk. I don't use those kind of terms. I use it because they're terms that Christians have kind of bought into. Mormons not typically talk that way unless we're trying to interface with the larger Christian world. You know, the fact that now you have Bibles, unfortunately you have 500 different versions of them, translated this way or that way, or, you know, I'm doing a new English version of it, and you're going, well, how much of it did you actually end up changing? Did you get it right? Did you pray and ask God for inspiration before you did it? Or did you just start doing it with your own understanding? Not saying that men's understanding is terrible, but we're often shut it off into weird directions. If you're not seeking help and humbly doing so from God, you know, the devil's going to be able to exercise some influence over it. And if you're using just your own knowledge to try and do that, well, you're sunk. Everything about this thing is about getting revelation from God. That's what faith plus anxiety equals revelation means. It's that important to me. And when people just go around willy-nilly and saying, hey, I think this is a good idea, and you go, is that backed up by inspiration that comes from God? Revelation in a different term? If they go, oh, no, I don't do that kind of stuff. And you go, oh, that's not good. Because it's very easy for you to be sidetracked away from what God really intended. And it's something where you go, hey, this sounds good, and I think this will appeal to people. And you go, you know what, a lot of what Satan does is very appealing. Anyway, I don't want to get into that. I don't want to get into the religious context of it particularly. I always find, I always want myself to be very non-dogmatic. I try to be the most non-dogmatic devout Mormon on the face of the earth. Not that I'm trying to compare, but just trying to say that I've come at it from a different perspective and still find God there, still find the LDS Church to be true. Even though I didn't get there predominantly through the same methodology that other people did. They tend to take a very non-dogmatic view, you know, trusting in men, trusting in the guys who sit up front on the stand on Sunday morning, and people say, well, you just have to believe them. They're inspired of God. They'll do it. And I'm sorry. I've sat in counsel with these men for years. And sometimes they are inspired. Often they are not. Sometimes they get a little too heady with the calling, like I was saying about bishops. Often bishops get very sucked into what they feel like is power, to the point to where they recommend men to be made elders, quorum, presidents, high priest, group leaders that don't threaten them. You know, I want to get somebody that will just listen to me raptly, so that I can accomplish what I want to do, and I don't have to get, I don't have to be questioned. You know, bishops don't like being questioned very much. And I have to say that I often question, especially when I said, I've read this in the book and we're not following the council. And they go, well, I'm the bishop, I can override that. And you go, Now, technically, in some ways, they can. Not really override. They are given a lot of flexibility, which many of them exercise. Sometimes they exercise more flexibility than they were actually given. I want to say that. And I don't want to say it's because they're bad people. The temptation to amass power and to reign is a stock human fallacy. And just because you're given a calling doesn't mean that you're going to be exempt from it. And, you know, I have to be worried about that because I often find myself in a position where I am called upon to lead in circumstances. And I have to be careful not to start getting lordly about it. And I've met some very lordly branch presidents and bishops. You know, it got to their heads. And of course, you know, the stock answer is do what they say and you'll be blessed. And I do. I try to. I really do. I grit my teeth when I have to speak against something that they've proposed and say, no, I don't think that's a good idea. Or I don't want to say no. I just say, I don't think that's a good idea. We should consider this. We should talk about this. This is why there is no one person who is a power unto himself in the church. You always have counselors. You always have a council. You have many councils. And one of the big things that is to do is to make sure that people don't get into horrible mistakes. People don't get drawn into circumstances they should be in. Anyway, so, I'm sorry, getting into that. Because these things happen, you know, no organization is perfect. Because there aren't perfect people in those jobs. And of course, there's ways that have been set up to kind of prevent this from happening, but it still can. A bishop can still make sure and call people who are yes men to be his counselors. Call kind of milquetoasty people to have the other leadership positions, and then he can dominate all of them. I've seen it happen. It doesn't happen very often, thank goodness. And I want to guard against that myself when I am put in those positions. I want to get people who are not afraid to say, hey, I think this is wrong. I don't think we should be doing this. We should be doing it this way instead. And to say, okay, well, let's think about it. Let's read the manual. That's my big thing. Let's read the manual. See what the leadership says. See what the brethren say. And if the brethren, you know, are silent, then we can, with inspiration, you have to get that anxiety in there, along with faith. You have to have faith, and then you have to have anxiety. It seems to come that way. First, you have to have faith. So you have to get some faithful men, and also ones that are really anxious about doing it right. And so that's what we are about. Anyway, so that was kind of a long one, and it was kind of a religious one. I have to do those every now and then, just because that's what's in my head. And I talk in this podcast about what comes into my head, because it's the life autistic. It's my life. What am I doing? I'm taking the back road. I'm taking the back road because I want to do the scenery, and I hate being on interstate. Whenever I can avoid interstate, I will. And going slower saves gas. Going fast gets you there faster, but it costs more. And frankly, when I'm relaxed and I'm not hurried, people get better work out of me. So I see those as my justifications for not taking the fastest road everywhere I go. This is Jay Nemro. You're listening to Life Autistic. I forget what I called this, but it doesn't really matter. I said it at the beginning, or I didn't say it at all, and now it's pointless. I will never listen to it all the way through again to hear what I call at the beginning, at the end, so there's no point doing it. If you would like to contact me, feel free. My email address is autism, AUTISM, @quix.us. Let me think. What else do I have to... Well, that's it. This has been episode number 660. Let me make sure I got my pointer. Have a great day.